On this about the last 6 months or so with Professor Herb, Professor Chibukula, Professor Tanabashi, and some other collaborators. Yesterday and the day before, Professor Chibukula told you about some of our work on deconstructed models, on Higgsless models, and today I'm going to tell you about a specific model that we looked at that is perhaps the smallest and simplest one of this type. And we can look at all of the phenomenology of this model and see how it displays all of the interesting characteristics that Professor Chibukula told you about in general. But because this model is relatively small and simple, we can follow all the details and see how things work out. So I'll just remind you of a few of the important principles of Higgsless models that will matter for this talk. We'll look at what the three-site model is. We'll look at unitarity delay, and then at a number of different experimental constraints on this model. And I should check, can you hear me in the back? Okay. So over the last couple days, you've heard about Higgsless models from Professor Chibukula. You've heard about them as low energy effective theories of dynamical symmetry breaking. And there are several important pieces that these models include. One is that they are based on five-dimensional gauge theories with appropriate boundary conditions, but we study them in four dimensions where we have some intuition about how the physics should work. The important thing about this kind of model that makes us call them a Higgsless model is that instead of having WW scattering unitarized by the presence of a scalar Higgs boson, instead it is the exchange of many different KK resonances, higher KK resonances of the ordinary W and Z that do this unitarization. And so that's one of the key features of the model. And the other thing is you heard about the language of deconstruction that allows you to have a nice four-dimensional representation, which makes these look like models with a very extended electroweak gauge group. And so the basic deconstructed Higgsless model, then, we have the fifth dimension running along this horizontal direction. It's latticized with an SU2 group at each point along the lattice. At the boundaries, we have a U1 group over here, an SU2 group over here, and we leave the F constants completely general and the gauge couplings of the different groups general so that our results can apply to any kind of warping or any profile for the gauge coupling across. You can't hear me. I need to hold it closer. Okay, is that better? All right, these things are sort of tricky. Okay, now I sound really loud to myself. Okay, luckily the first slides have been, I think, relatively straightforward and repeats of things that you've seen. Okay, I'm figuring it's the last morning, people need to wake up slowly and not rush into new things too quickly. Okay, so this again is a very generalized Higgsless model, and in the simplest case, one would have the fermions sit on the brains at site zero and at site n plus one. But as you heard yesterday, this kind of arrangement for the fermions doesn't really work phenomenologically because we run into a conflict. On the one hand, we need these heavy KK modes, as I said, to unitarize WW scattering. And if you want that to work out properly, it turns out that the lightest KK mode can't weigh more than about one or one and a half TeV. But on the other hand, if the lightest KK mode is this light, then because the size of the S parameter depends on the KK mode masses, you get a value of the S parameter that is too large, according to experiment. And this is, it's large enough that even if you slightly shift the top quark mass, as CDF and D0 keep doing, you still can't fix the problem. So it's not possible to have the fermions sitting on the boundaries, no matter what you do with the warping or the gauge coupling or the top quark mass. Instead, what seems to be necessary is to try a different idea, which is allowing the fermions, instead of sitting strictly on the boundaries, to have the fermions have some profile in the fifth dimension so that they are delocalized instead of being localized. And here one writes it formally so that you have the fermion current coupling to each different gauge group with a factor x sub I, so giving the fraction of the fermion that is at each site. And so generally what you might expect that the fermion might still mostly be localized at this end, for example, but have a small extension out into the bulk. And this was found then to reduce the size of contributions to S by these different groups. And indeed, what we found in particular was that there's a way to ensure that S will vanish at tree level. And that is to remember that the W is orthogonal to each of its KK modes, and they are orthogonal to one another. And in that case, it means that if we chose the wave function, the profile of the fermion, to match the profile of the W, automatically the profile of the fermion will be orthogonal to all of the KK modes, so that the fermion current will not couple to any KK mode. We won't have any such tree-level coupling. And then if you recall the different precision electroweak corrections that Professor Tanabashi talked about in his lectures, the S, T, W, and Y, for example, and that sort of notation, then it turns out that three of them are guaranteed to be zero if there's no couple, no tree-level coupling between the fermions and the KK modes, and then the fourth one is generally very small. So this kind of ideal fermion delocalization, then, is what we'll use to make sure that the phenomenology of precision electroweak corrections works. So now let's apply this to a particular model where we can see how one actually calculates these things. And we call this the three-site model. And I looked up a three-site model on Google, as people do nowadays for everything. And I found in biology, if you had a three-site model, it looks like a mess. This is a model of the three prime end of a strand of DNA, where you're looking at the telomeres that control how long cells, how many generations a cell can divide before it dies. So this is very important in biology, but very messy looking. And we're lucky to be particle physicists, where our three-site model just looks like three gauge groups hooked together, which is something that we can easily do calculations with. So this is then it's a deconstructed model, but our bulk consists of only a single SU2 group, and then we have a boundary SU2 group and a boundary U1 group. And that's all of the gauge groups that we have to worry about here. And we will, we'll be doing our calculations, assuming that, that G1, the gauge coupling of the middle group, is the strongest of the three. And the if we look at the gauge boson spectrum then of this extended electroweak gauge sector, we would find that we'll have a photon, we'll have something that looks pretty close to the standard Z, we'll have a light W as well, and then we'll have a single Z prime and a single set of W primes, and that's all. So we only have one set of KK resonances, the Z prime and the W prime, to worry about, not some very large number, because we only have one extra gauge group. So that will make calculations very tractable and let them fit nicely onto a transparency. No huge mass matrices or anything like that. Now, if we think about fermions, what we'll do then is we have a left-handed fermion here at the boundary, and we have a direct fermion here. With so we've got both a left-handed and a right-handed component here, both coupling to the middle gauge group. And then out here where the U1 gauge group is, we have the right-handed weak singlet fermions then sitting out here. So our fermion spectrum, again, is going to have ordinary fermions like a top quark and a bottom quark, but it will also have one KK mode for each. So one heavy top, one heavy bottom quark, if we're just thinking about the quarks of the third generation. And so each side node is an SU2 doublet. And one can add in the other generations. And again, in each case, there would be an ordinary set of quarks and then one heavy set as well. So that's the basic structure of the model. And then if we look in a little bit more detail at what the fermion mass terms look like, we find the following. So So here, this psi left 0 is our left-handed boundary fermion. Psi 1 is our fermions sitting here in the bulk. And then this TR2 and BR2 are our right-handed boundary fermions. this is the set of mass terms and Yukawa coupling terms in the Lagrangian. And you can see that the bulk fermion is able to have a Dirac mass. Both psi right and psi left 1 are weak doublets. We've got a Yukawa coupling here between this left-handed fermion and this right-handed fermion. So that's this Yukawa coupling here. And its strength is given by a factor epsilon L. And the size of epsilon L measures essentially the degree of delocalization of the left-handed fermion. And then over here we have a Yukawa coupling between this left-handed fermion and this right-handed fermion over here. And so we have a matrix, so a component for T right and a component for B right. So this epsilon T right and epsilon B right measure the relative strengths of the Yukawa couplings of the top and bottom quarks here. So note that weak isospin violation comes here in the fact that these Yukawa couplings do not have to be the same as one another, whereas this epsilon L here is weak isospin conserving, so that'll be important later on. And this general fermion structure is then motivated by thinking about what a five-dimensional continuum version of such a theory would look like, and as the flavor structure is then the same as in the standard model, with the flavor symmetry breaking all coming here in the Yukawa couplings. So what one can do then is figure out what the W wave function looks like, what the fermion wave functions look like, what the formulas for the masses are in terms of the various parameters of the model. So we have a nice small mass matrix for the W bosons. X is what we're going to call the ratio of the zero site gauge coupling and the one site gauge coupling. This is supposed to, remember, be a small parameter. So we diagonalize this mass matrix and find in terms of the W mass and W prime mass that we can write X, this ratio of gauge couplings, as essentially the ratio of the W and W prime mass. And we find a formula for the wave function of the W boson. So there's a piece that's at site 0, there's a piece that's at site 1. And the important thing to remember here is just that these are a function of X, so of the ratio of gauge couplings, or the ratio of masses, if you like. That's the important thing about that formula. And similarly, we can diagonalize the mass matrix for the fermions. So here's the general form. It depends on the degree of delocalization and these Yukawa couplings here. And so that generally one finds then that the mass of a given fermion, whether the top quark, the bottom quark, or any other quark, is the product of the degree of delocalization, which is also, note, the same for all flavors. It doesn't have an index saying that it's different from one fermion to another. So this epsilon L, the Yukawa coupling for the particular fermion, and then this overall mass scale M, the Dirac mass. M was just this Dirac mass of the bulk fermion. And then again, one can find the wave function of the left-handed top quark, for example, or the right-handed top quark. And the important thing in these formulas, again, is that they simply depend on epsilon L and then the Yukawa coupling for the particular flavor. And so then what we'd like to do, first of all, is make sure that we think about what it means to have our fermions be ideally delocalized, since that's what we need to do in order to make all of the precision electroweak corrections be small. So literally, how do we find out what should the fermion profile be? Well, we think about the ideal delocalization condition that we talked about, which is that the appropriate gauge coupling times the squared component of the fermion at a given site should be proportional to the W wave function at that given site. So I is either site 0 or site 1 or site 2, just whichever site you're looking at. And of course, the W boson is only on sites 0 and site 1 because site 2 is a U1, so there's no component of the W boson there. So we actually have two separate ideal delocalization conditions, one for site 0 up in the numerator, and I've divided it by the condition written for site one. And that's all that we have to satisfy in the three-site model. So we may as well look at the ratio so that the overall factor of the weak coupling will just drop out of this. But now if I think about this equation, this is an equation that involves G0 and G1, the gauge couplings, or rather their ratio, which is x. It involves these components of the W, which we've just calculated, and those just depend on x. And then it depends on the components of the top quark, for example, or whichever quark we're looking at site 0 and site 1. And we calculated those on the last slide, and those simply depended on epsilon L, the delocalization fraction, which is the thing that we're trying to figure out at the moment, and they also depend on the Yukawa coupling. So overall, this condition that we're looking at can be thought of as an equation for epsilon L in terms of the Yukawa coupling and X. And so we can just solve that and find out what epsilon L needs to be in order for the fermion to be ideally delocalized. And so that's what we do, and this is the formula that you find. So it has some dependence on the Yukawa couplings and on X, and then their higher order corrections. And then if you think for a minute, you say to yourself, the top quark Yukawa coupling is much, much larger than the Yukawa coupling for any other fermion, because of course the other fermions are much lighter. And so, in fact, the Yukawa coupling for any other fermion is going to be much less than one, meaning that it can actually be ignored in this formula. So for any of the light fermions, we ignore the factors of the Yukawa coupling, and we find something much simpler, that epsilon L, the delocalization fraction, depends only on X, and we remember that X can be just written as the ratio of the heavy W mass over the light W mass over the heavy W mass. So we find a relatively simple expression for the delocalization fraction. We say, fine, that's the answer we wanted. If epsilon L takes this value, then the W prime and the Z prime will be fermiophobic. They won't couple to any of the ordinary quarks and leptons. All the precision electroweak corrections will be small or vanishing at tree level, and we're set. So in this simple kind of a model, we can solve very directly for the fermion profile that will make the precision electroweak correction small. And in this case, then, you might wonder, how would you look for the W prime and Z prime, since you can't find them in through decays to fermions? You'll have to look for resonances that they might cause in WW scattering directly. Okay, so unitarity delay. This is a familiar slide that you saw from Professor Chivukula, just reminding you that generally the S matrix should be unitary. And therefore, if we're just looking at elastic scattering of, say, W's into W's, then you would expect that the Born amplitude should stay less than a half in order for unitarity to be respected. And if we think about this in terms of elastic WW scattering in this model, we'll be looking at the longitudinal modes, because those are the ones we worry about. Those are the ones that might cause problems at high energy. And if we think in terms of just an SU2 model, for simplicity, since we're only worried about the W scattering, then the easiest way to do the calculation is to use the equivalence theorem, and remember that the properties of the longitudinal W's are the same as the properties of the Eaton-Goldstone bosons. And doing a calculation then of pi on scattering, we would say that we would have to worry then about a 4 pi on self-coupling, and then pi on scattering mediated by exchange of the KK modes. So one could then write down very standard sorts of formulas for the scattering amplitude, including the 4-point coupling. You'll have the 4-point coupling in each of these, and basically you can then write the amplitude in terms of propagators involving these heavy W exchanges you see here. So you have a sum over all of the different KK modes. And what you'd find if you focus specifically on isosinglet S-wave scattering, so you make this combination of amplitudes by swapping Mandelstam variables about appropriately and summing them up to get the isosinglet piece. You do a projection with the zeroth Legendre polynomial to pick out the S-wave scattering. Then what you would find is that if the first KK mode is too heavy, then it's not going to do the job of unitarizing the cross-section that you hoped it would do. So if you set its mass up to infinity, you'll find that the S-wave scattering, the isosinglet S-wave scattering, will very quickly become too large and violate your unitarity bound, as we said, at an energy of around 1 or 1.5 TeV. So as the mass of the of that first KK mode becomes lighter and lighter, you find that the amplitude climbs towards a value of a half more and more gradually. And so here, you find that the onset of a unitarity violation problem here is now delayed to something more like 5 TeV. So this is a calculation done in the continuum limit. And what we'd like to see is, what would this look like if we do the calculation in the three-site model, where we actually only have one single KK resonance to worry about instead of a whole sum. But in order to do that, we have to remember that it's not only elastic scattering that can happen. As you heard yesterday, you actually have to worry about inelastic channels. You could have the W pair scatter into a pair of KK resonances, or the opposite could occur. And so you have to take all of these things into account. So in other words, in order to make sure that the S matrix is unitary, the real condition now is a condition on the maximum value of the eigenvalues of this piece of the S matrix has to be less than a half. And so, again, if we look very specifically in the three-site model now, where we'll now look, since we're looking at coupled channels, we'll look at the scattering of the longitudinal Ws, not only into longitudinal Ws, but also into the single KK resonance. And again, we'll look at spin zero and isospin zero scattering. Then we find the following. So this is looking at what happens if the mass of the KK mode is about 400 JeV. This is if it's about 600 JeV. The black curve, let's see, this is the size of the scattering amplitude versus scattering energy. The black curve is what we would get in the three-site model by only looking at elastic scattering. And from that, we would conclude that we have unitarity delay out to about 2 TeV. But if we do the correct coupled channel analysis, we find instead that the scattering into the KK resonances actually alters things a bit, and we see that the scale of unitarity violation is, well, it's pulled down a little bit. It's not quite 2 TeV. If we look at a slightly heavier W prime, then the difference between them is less, but nonetheless, it's actually there. But you notice that we're not getting a delay of unitarity violation out to 5 TeV in the three-site model. We're only getting a delay out to something of order 1.5, 1.8 TeV, something like that. So there's a modest enhancement in the scale of unitarity violation in the three-site model, enough to show that the effect is there, not so dramatic that it's incredibly impressive. Okay. So let's look at a bunch of other experimental constraints and see how they play out in this model. It turns out that the model is simple enough that we can do even one-loop calculations of various quantities and see what they look like. So the first is triple gauge vertices. And as you heard yesterday, these Higgsless models are probably the first kind of model where the constraints on the anomalous three-point gauge couplings actually are one of the principal constraints on the model. Existing experimental data is enough to place a constraint. And so here is the famous relation from Hagawara and collaborators defining delta kappa z, delta kappa gamma, and delta gz1, the anomalous three-point gauge couplings. And then the three-site model, delta kappa is zero, and therefore the other two are equal to one another. And we find that each of these anomalous three-point couplings is proportional to the ratio of the W mass squared over the W prime mass squared. And this is a large enough, this is large enough if the W prime mass is of order 400 or 500 JeV, that this would give a visible effect. So for example, at LEP 2 then, this is the bound at 95% confidence level. And if you then apply that to this relation here, you find that the W prime has to be heavier than about 400 JeV. So again, there's a direct constraint on the model from LEP 2. This is the only kind of model that the LEP 2 measurement is good enough to constrain right now. And so that's actually pretty impressive. But we'll hold that in mind for the moment and go back to remembering that we had talked about calculating what the fermion profile had to look like in order for the light fermions to be ideally delocalized, and we'd found this relationship. And now knowing that the heavy W has to weigh at least 380 JeV, we can rewrite this expression then as that the delocalization fraction is about 0.3. Then if we remember at the same time that, so this is the constraint here, is a lower bound on the W prime mass. But we remember that we have an upper bound on the W prime mass, because if the W prime is too heavy, then it wouldn't do the job of unitarizing WW scattering. And we said much earlier on that the W prime has to be lighter than about 1.2 TeV in order to unitarize W prime scattering. So that gives an upper bound then on the value of epsilon L. The upper bound on the W mass gives, W prime mass gives a lower bound on epsilon L. So we conclude that the delocalization fraction has to be relatively small, between about 0.01 and 0.3. A second thing that we can look at is beta S gamma. The reason that we might worry about this is because, you remember that the bulk fermion has a right-handed doublet of fermions. So that means that there is a right-handed W top-bottom coupling in this model. And if that's too large, it will make beta S gamma happen at too great a rate. And so what Larios, Perez, and Yuan have shown is that this ratio of the right-handed over left-handed W top-bottom coupling has to really be quite small to agree with beta S gamma. And so this translates then into a bound on this Yukawa coupling for the top. It has to be less than about 2/3. Now this piece of information is just one piece, but in fact we can actually leverage it to get some more information, because we remember that the mass of any given fermion is its Yukawa coupling times the delocalization fraction, it's common to all fermions, times this Dirac mass. The big quark mass is actually very small, meaning that this term in the denominator doesn't actually matter very much, and so we can actually use this. We can use this to deduce then, knowing the B quark mass and knowing epsilon L, we can deduce that the Yukawa coupling for the B quark is in fact quite small, much smaller than the upper bound for the top quark. Knowing this, we can say to ourselves, if we go back and think about the expression that we had for, if we go back and look at this expression here, remember, that tells us about the size of the delocalization fraction. Since the Yukawa coupling for the B is so small, it's only about 0.015, that means that the B quark is like the other light quarks, where the delocalization fraction is actually going to have this simple form. So you might have thought, originally looking at this formula for the delocalization fraction, since it does depend on the Yukawa coupling for the fermion that you're thinking about, technically speaking, the fermion profile, the profile required to ideally delocalize each flavor of fermion is actually different. The profile for the charm quark would be a little different than the profile for the strange quark, a little different than the profile for the bottom quark. But as long as the Yukawa coupling is small enough that you can neglect it, then they all pretty much have the same profile to within the order of any calculation that we might be doing. And that's true for all of the light fermions. We've just seen that the bottom quark is already in this limit, and that means that all of the other light quarks will also be in this limit, and they'll all have essentially the same profile. The top quark is the only one that will have a different would have a different value of epsilon L than any of the others would. So that's important to have seen. Okay. Because we might have wondered whether the bottom quark, being in the third generation, would be ideally delocalized like the other light fermions or not. Always we wonder about the rho parameter. And we can actually calculate the contributions of new physics to the rho parameter quite directly here, because if we remember, we've seen that the size of any of the fermion masses, the ordinary fermion masses, are proportional to epsilon L, so the masses of the top and bottom quark in particular. The standard model contribution to the rho parameter comes from the difference in mass between the top and bottom quarks. So if we work in the limit where epsilon L is zero, then the standard model contribution will vanish because these two quarks will be massless, they will be degenerate, and therefore there won't be any contribution to delta rho. The new physics contributions, though, won't be proportional to epsilon L. They're proportional to the Yukawa couplings instead, and so they'll still be present. So this is just kind of a nice trick in the three-site model for doing the calculation of delta rho without having too many diagrams to do. So by working in this limit, then all we have to do is calculate these kinds of diagrams involving the heavy partners of the top and bottom quarks. And here, the bottom quark and top quark will be massless in this calculation, but that's fine because we expect the heavy partners to be significantly heavier. And so then doing the calculation, we find indeed that the size of the correction to the rho parameter goes like the top quark Yukawa coupling raised to the fourth power. So this is two-thirds raised to the fourth power or smaller. So it's not a terribly big correction. So at this point, we have enough information to figure out just how heavy the heavy partners of the ordinary fermions are going to be. And the conditions that we use to set the boundaries of the allowed values of the Dirac mass and epsilon L are these conditions. We know the formula for the mass of any ordinary fermion. It's just epsilon L times the Yukawa coupling for the fermion times the Dirac mass. We have this calculation of delta rho that we just got, which is in terms of the Yukawa coupling. And we have these bounds that we derived on epsilon L from the triple gauge vertices and unitarity. So these bounds on epsilon L give these vertical lines here, and the size of the correction to the rho parameter sets this band of bounds right here, and so it's this region up here that is allowed. Now if we look at that, we notice that the lightest that the Dirac mass, or the lightest that the mass of the heavy partners of the fermions could be, is something like 3 TeV, 3 to 5 TeV. So those heavy partners are in fact very heavy. And another way of writing it might be to compare the masses of the heavy fermions with the masses of the W. In order to do that, we just use the relationship between epsilon L and the mass of the KK resonance and apply that to the previous plot. We have then the vertical lines are then the lower bound of 380 GeV on the W prime mass and the upper bound of 1.2 TeV. Now the allowed region is up here. And again, we see that no matter what, the heavy fermions are always much heavier than the W prime. So that's kind of interesting, that's the condition under which the model can exist and still satisfy the experimental constraints. Now that creates an interesting situation when we go to look at... Oops. me just, I'll come back to the other in a minute, that creates an interesting situation when we want to look at when we want to look at R sub B, when we want to look at Z goes to BB bar, because the corrections to Z to BB bar involve the heavy states, and their mass at 3 to 5 TeV or higher is actually above the range of validity of our effective theory. Our effective theory is valid only up to something more like of order the mass of up into the sort of 1 TeV range. So in order to actually look at the size of corrections to Z goes to BB bar, we actually have to invoke some kind of a UV completion for our theory in order to move beyond the effective theory to a more complete theory that would reach up into the mass range where the heavy fermions even exist. So we just did used a very simple kind of UV completion to estimate the size of the effects, and we find that they go as the top quark mass squared. Sorry, if we compare the shift in the Z to BB bar coupling to the size of the Z to BB bar coupling in the standard model, then we find that this is of order the top quark mass squared over this 5 TeV mass squared. So the overall the correction is suppressed by a large enough factor suppressed to a large enough degree that it's not really going to be noticeable on this scale of the experimental accuracy. There's something that you might have worried about that usually plagues five-dimensional gauge theories, which would be a correction of something like this to Z goes to BB bar, where you'd have some sort of gauge boson exchange, KK mode exchange, between the top quark and the B quarks in here, and which would make this diagram, which can actually have a relatively large log here. So this is the kind of correction that usually exists, but in our case, the KK modes available to provide this four-point coupling, the KK modes have actually been engineered to be fermiophobic. We've ideally delocalized our fermions, and so this vertex, this four-point coupling, does not exist in the three-site model or in our ideally delocalized models at all. So this large coupling actually is not there to worry about. This is the leading effect, and it's small. Okay. So then I just wanted to mention, we very recently, Professor Chivukula and I and Shinya Matsuzuki from Nagoya have done a calculation of the S parameter and the T parameter at one loop in the three-site model. And we calculated, so there are a lot of different diagrams that you actually have to calculate. So this is a Landau gauge calculation. So we have the two-point functions. We also have to worry to make a gauge invariant calculation about contributions from vertex and potentially box diagrams. And the bottom line is that you actually get a rather nice answer. So alpha s in the three-site model, first there's a tree-level piece. This x is, that would be our epsilon factor in the notation we're using here. And the point is that this is the ideal delocalization factor that we choose to have the value that would just cancel this out. We found that x has the value of 1 over this quantity here, as I've already showed you. So this tree-level piece is the part that ideal delocalization removes. The one-loop calculation, then, gives us a contribution that's in a form that should look very familiar. It's just the same kind of form that you get in that calculation in the standard model, where in the standard model you'd have instead a Higgs mass over the Higgs reference mass. So this would be the kind of term that you'd use in the standard model to worry about what if your Higgs mass was different than the reference mass you used in your calculation. So this is the contribution that is for the physics up to the scale of the W prime mass, and then for physics between the W prime mass and the cutoff of the theory, there's this additional piece here, and then there are appropriate counter terms, which are like the L10 terms that you've seen mentioned in terms of the electrochiral Lagrangian in earlier talks. So overall, the nice thing about this calculation is that we've seen we have the tree-level piece is canceled by ideal delocalization. The one-loop piece is of a form that we could actually, in principle, compare it to the calculations in the standard model using a reference Higgs mass. Similarly, the calculation for the t-parameter comes out, again, the piece that lets you do the comparison with the with experiment in the way that it's usually shown, the piece going between the W prime mass and the cutoff, and then piece from the leading isospin violating counter term. Okay. So what I've tried to convey to you is that the three-site model is a useful toy model to look at to understand how to do calculations in the context of a Higgsless model with ideal delocalization. It's a simple enough theory that you can actually do the calculations of observables like S and T or Z to BB bar at one loop. It is complicated enough to incorporate all of the different general principles like deconstruction, ideal delocalization, and so on. We see a way to accommodate the heavy top quark without running into problems with either R sub B or any of the precision electroweak corrections. And finally, as a bonus, the theory has extra gauge bosons that can be relatively light. They may be a bit tricky to find because they're fermiophobic and you have to look for them in WW scattering, but at least we have some kind of a signal to tell our experimental colleagues to go look for, and that's always a nice thing when you create a new model to give the experimentalists something to go after. So thank you for your attention.
This is probably the last chance for you to ask particular things about his lecture, about her lectures.
A general question. So in the beginning, you have showed us a picture of DNA. We know that the function of DNA is almost mainly determined by the space configurations, all the geometries. So, later you have shown us how to build a three-side models, and we can calculate ST and so on. So, I'd like to ask, or I'm curious about, do you try to convince us, or do you believe that the basic principle of the physics is determined by a geometric or by algebraic. So how do you think about it?
I think that a lot of the structure, a lot of what we've been able to prove about Higgs's models is independent of the geometry, it's independent of the warping. There are some particular details of how the, say, the unitarity delay calculation would work out, or the precise values you get for certain quantities that do depend on the geometry, but the basic structure of the model, a lot of it is independent of the warping, independent of the exact geometry. I think that's what I would say, is that there's a mix. A lot of it is independent. Some details will depend on the geometry that you look at.
You think it didn't? It is geometry independent, or
much of the structure is independent of the geometry. The general proof about needing to delocalize the fermions, for example, that was completely independent of the warping, but the detail of exactly what value you will get for an experimental observable will depend on the warping, because I mean that comes into a lot of the calculations. But the general idea of whether you can get a value that agrees with experiment is generally true regardless of the warping. So there's a mix of dependence, I think.
Thank you. I have two questions. The first one is, at the beginning of the lecture, you said the KK mode resonance is important in the study of unitary of this theory. How to include the resonance in this theory? Do you mean you use the idea of fitting of symmetry?
Well, I mean, the KK modes have been appear, the KK mode, the W prime, has appeared all through the calculations here very directly.
I mean, how to include the resonance in this theory, in the model? Like you only have pseudo Goldstones at the beginning of the model building, right? After the symmetry breaking.
For the pi-pi scattering, we use the equivalence theorem and use the Goldstone modes. But in looking at the ideal delocalization and the properties of the KK modes, we were using the full KK mode, not just the Eaton pion. So we use the full KK mode all the time. That was the W prime or the Z prime mode that I referred to throughout.
I mean, how to include the coupling between W and the KK mode resonance? The coupling between W and the KK mode resonance.
Between the dope, well, any of the couplings are they're just overlap integrals between the wave function at any at the wave functions appearing at any given site.
My second question is, in the recover coupling, you said maybe the CP violation arranged from the like CKL matrix, right?
I said the flavor structure was the same.
Yeah. I think. I can always set the recover coupling constant to be real, then there will be no CKM phase. And how to include the CKM, the CP violation? You know, in some models like 2KSW model, we have spontaneous CP violation, and can this theory include this?
Well, I think it just includes it to the same degree that the Yukawa matrix in the standard model does, not anymore. Than the standard model does. I mean, the flavor structure is the same. In much of what we did, we assumed that the Yukawa couplings of most of the light quarks were very small. So then, if we assume any of them are zero, of course, that takes away the possibility of CP violation, certainly.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions?
So please turn to the slide, the one loop correction to S parameters.
One or the next one?
The formula.
Yeah,
I understand the three-sign model is a Higgs-Lis model, right?
Yes.
So I don't understand why the contribution of the Higgs mass term, the logarithm term, appeared here.
Okay. This is just the reference Higgs mass, not the actual mass of any Higgs boson in the theory.
Oh yeah, I see. Oh, so you just make a subtraction from the...
It's just the subtraction.
Yeah,
that's
see.
All that is. That's
okay,
right.
Okay.
And having that there, of course, means we can compare with the calculations people do in the standard model, for example.
Okay.
Okay, any more questions, comments? Seems to still have a few more minutes.
That may be time for a break between how we say this.
Right. So if no more questions, I think our next session will start still by 10, right? By 10, so we will have maybe more time for coffee break and some other things. Okay, so no more questions. Let's thank Lisa again for...
Thank you.